Okay, so welcome to week 12. Let's get started with our first headline of the day, which actually circulated in from channels as well, as you'll see in just a second. Family kicked off American Airlines flight after body odor complaints. Made it all the way to global news here this week. So, a Jewish family from Detroit were left mortified after they got booted from an American Airlines flight when passengers complained about their body odor. Yossi Adler, his wife, and their 19-month-old were trying to catch a flight back home Wednesday after taking a vacation in Florida when they were turfed from the flight. All of a sudden, as soon as they took us off, they closed the gate and they said, "Sorry, sir, some people complained you had body odor and we're not letting you back on," Adler told WPLG News. Making matters worse, the family was told their luggage would be removed from the plane. The luggage never made it off the plane. Off the flight. "They have our car seat, our stroller, everything," Jenny Adler said. Speaking with Local 10 News on Thursday, the family denied having any stink. "There's no body odor that we have," Alder said, as he and his family waited at Miami International Airport for another flight. "There's nothing wrong with us." American Airlines issued a statement confirming the reason why the family was removed from their flight. Mr. Adler and his wife were removed from the flight when several passengers complained about their body odor, the company said. "They have been booked into a hotel for the night and given meal vouchers. They have been rebooked on a flight Thursday." Bewildered by the reason, the family said they asked complete strangers in the airport if they thought they stink. "We stopped several people in the airport, and it's embarrassing, but we asked them, 'Do you think we smell? Because we just got kicked off a plane for smelling.'" Alder's wife said, and they were like, "Oh my God, we're so embarrassed for you that someone would do such a thing. No." Speaking to NBC News in Detroit, the family said they believe they were kicked from the flight because of their religion, not because they smell. "As I go to the gate, they are all holding their nose, using paper to blow around their nose, you know, pretending it smells," the man said. "That was upsetting, that the man said, 'Oh, you Orthodox people don't take showers.' That's what he told me. He thought we don't take showers for that." I'm like, "That's absurd," Alder told NBC News. As of this writing, American Airlines has not responded to the family's accusation. There's a lot to unpack here, as usual, with these type of articles. The first is I could not find any sources that prohibit showering, so there goes that. the first thing that you sort of want to think about here is, just from our perspective, just the Lashon Hara concerns involved here, that certainly when we hear things like this, and, you know, even enough that I was hesitant to bring it, I mean, there's a lot of Torah to be learned from this, as we're going to see. Albeit in a little bit of a weird fashion, but certainly to remember that, you know, Hilchos Lashon Hara applies, you know, all the more so to news articles. And in case you didn't believe the family's version of the story, you know, there may be halachos associated with that as well, which I'm not here to talk about, but it's something we always should keep in mind as, you know, giving people the benefit of the doubt. Certainly this is a very strange story. That I think we can all agree on. Yeah, you know, just to make sure that we don't accept this as Lashon Hara if it is intended as being so. I mean, I think this article does a nice job of portraying both sides, certainly fairly. Now, the question I wanted to open with was a question of, so, if do other passengers on the plane have the right to complain about someone's smell? Fair question. Now, what about halachically? And that's what I'd like to try to explore here.
Like if you take an instance where, for example, an individual is wearing a very strong perfume or cologne,
mm-hmm.
Then, you know, a person might have an allergic reaction to that, or, you know, that's a huge issue.
Right, so that...
I would think that a person in a position of authority with the flight would have to verify, and then they would take charge.
Right. I mean,
did a person with authority take charge here and investigate it and kick them off?
Right. I mean, I don't know if it was investigated from the company's retelling, or even from his retelling, actually. They're all holding their nose, using paper to blow around their nose, you know, pretending it smells. At the very least, if it didn't smell, they were pretending that it did, and it seemed like that was something that the crew was aware of, right? They said, as we go to the gate, they were all holding their nose. That sounds like there was a lot of people that were either in on this, or they had heard, and, you know, you start psychologically, you know, right. Oh, of course they smell. Or, in fact, they did, right? We don't know what actually took place. Mm-hmm. But the perfume one is very important, and that's, you know, that question is a very important halakhic question, especially relating to allergies. You'll notice in a lot of shuls that I've seen, you know, that warn people, please don't wear any strong smelling scents because people have allergies to them. But I'm here to talk about specifically a bad smell that's caused by people and what it may have to do in terms of, you know, the halachos that sort of govern Ben Adam al-Chaver, in this case what we know as Hilchos Shcheinim, sort of what you're allowed to do for your neighbors, right? We know we have zoning laws. So, you know, if you want to expand your house, you can't make this much noise, and you can't make it this tall, you can't make it this wide, you can't do this, you can't do that. The Torah also has a number of rules that apply to, you know, keeping clear of, you know, damaging neighbor's property. Where did we have this in an earlier shiur? Anybody remember? We had a number of weeks back where you had the person who decided to shoot the dog that urinated on his lawn. And there, too, we talked about some of the rules of keeping urine off other people's property and even distancing it from someone else's property. That was also in the Gemara in Bava Basra. So here we look at another Gemara in Bava Basra and source number one. The Gemara tells us in the Mishnah, which I didn't bring here. I brought a number of other things, but not the Mishnah. And the question is basically for a, I think that's pronounced dovecot, but I don't have any idea. It's basically sort of like, again, a containment for birds. And what happens is the Mishnah suggests a certain amount of space that you should have around it, you know, between that and where your neighbors live. If, however, says the Mishnah, you bought this dovecote with the land around it, and there are people living around that, meaning it's been there already before, and now you're buying that land, you don't have to readjust sort of the borders around it and say, oh, well, you know, now I need this and this amount of space. Why? The Mishnah says that you can assume that if the people have been living with it until now, they're okay with it within this distance. What they are going to call a chazaka, haru b'chazkaso, or what they call it in the English translation, acquired privilege of use. And so the question is really, you know, if people are okay with something, how is that going to work in terms of damages? Meaning, if I say, you know what, the person sitting next to me on the plane smells, but I couldn't care the less. Is that something that I can change my mind about? Can I complain about it? How's that going to work? And in fact, the Gemara is going to tell us, but asks the Gemara, but Rav Nachman said that there's no chazaka for nezikin. That when it comes to cases of damage, and here we're talking about, you know, again, we're assuming the doves will damage, you know, the surroundings in some way. So ask the Gemara, how can we say harayu b'chazka, so that you don't have to readjust the borders because we assume the people there are okay with it. But says Rav Nachman, there's no such thing as chazaka l'nezikin, meaning a person can complain about nezikin at any time. If something is damaging to them or their property, just because one day they didn't complain about it, or even if they haven't complained about it for 12 years, if they decide to come back and now complain about it, we don't say, oh, you have a chazaka that you didn't care. We always listen to their claims when it comes to complaints of damages. And in fact, answers the Gemara, Rav Mari Amar Bekutra, Rav Zvid Amar Beves HaKisei. Says the Gemara, this is not a problem. When Rav Nachman, in the name of Rabba Bar Avua, made that statement, it was not referring to all types of damages. It wasn't referring to your regular, you know, dove damages. It was referring to one of two things, and this is a machlokas in the Gemara. Rav Mari says it was referring only to smoke. When you have smoke going around where you are, that's something where you always retain the right to complain. Smoke is actually much more relevant in our times in terms of, you know, cigarette smoking and things like this, which we consider very dangerous. Secondhand smoke, I mean, there you're even dealing with questions of life and death, potentially, and we're not going to explore that more, but the damage that smoke costs and the, you know, the feeling that it has, the smell that it has, that's something, says Rav Mari, that a person has the right to always be makbid on, meaning, even though they haven't complained about it for a while and we can assume that they're okay with it, that's not the case. You always have the right to complain about it, and therefore to ask this person to move it within a safe distance as prescribed by halacha. On the other hand, Rav Zvid says no. It's not about a smoke case. It's about the case of a Beis HaKisei. And as you see the English filling in here, it's referring to a bathroom whose odor is particularly strong. So we see that according to the Gemara, this is a case where someone, you know, assumed, you know, mechila, as we're going to call it, meaning assuming that the person doesn't mind, is not something that lasts forever. As soon as someone complains, you have to go back and follow halacha. You can't say, oh, just because, you know, you didn't mind it until now doesn't mean you can now start complaining. And in fact, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, okay, it's talking about the distancing from other people's property. Again, these sort of things. So a bad smell that's being distanced from someone else's property, and we're going to talk about it. Kol haracha kosin source number two. She amarnu im lo hirchik veracha verov shasak harezem machal. Any distancing about which we have said that if the person didn't distance it from his friend's property, and the friend saw it, and the friend didn't mind it, was quiet, we assume that he was mochel. Okay, he, you know, pardoned this behavior. V'eino yachol lachzor ulhatzricho leharchik. And from that point on, this is Shulchan Aruch, halacha lemaisa, saying from that point on, you have no right to ask this person to move it because you were fine with it beforehand. Okay? V'hu shera'a mimenu shemachal. And this is obviously has to be in a case where you saw very clearly that the person was mochel, meaning, if you helped, you know, if the guy helped you out doing whatever it is, you know, let's say you have a big, and, you know, any sort of damaging thing that's at the edge of your property, and your neighbor's like, hey, how's it going? As he sees you, you know, doing this damaging act. Osha amar lo la'asos, or he told you to do it. Osha ra'ahu she'asa betzido below harchaka v'shasak, or that he saw he was doing it right on the edge of his property and he was quiet. V'lo hikbit al zeh, and he was not makbit on that. So all of these rules apply when? Bamed varim amurim says Shulchan Aruch after the three dots. When is this the case? Bishar nizakim with all other damages. Chutz me arba. Except for four types of damage. What are the four types of damage that you always have the right to protest? And you always have the right to tell the person, move that. It's distance. Arba amos away from my yard. Okay, under certain cases. Shehem, what are they? Ashan, number one, smoke, as the Gemara said. Two, Reach Beis Hakisei, a really bad bathroom smell. Three, V'avak V'keyotzebo, and dust and things like that. V'nidnun Hakarka, and you know, moving around the land. I'm not sure exactly what that would mean. Shekol Echan Me'elu Ein Lo Chazaka, all of these four items don't have Chazaka, and therefore, V'afilu Shasa Kama Shanim, even if you were quiet about it for many years, you can go back to the person and say, no, I'm sorry, I am no longer mochel this, you've got to move it away.
So Hezekriah isn't in here?
Hezekriah is in those halachos around there, but it's not directly mentioned in this.
Oh.
Yes?
So it's only Arba Amos that they have to move it after they're gone?
So it's different cases. I don't remember exactly what it is for each of these different things, but when we talked about distancing things from someone else's wall, we spoke about Arba Amos, I believe. I think. Maybe it was Tfachim. I have to go back to this. Certainly it's something significant enough that it has to be moved away from the property lines of the other person. Now, whether or not an airplane has property lines and whether or not you're actually renting your seat when you're going on the airplane or not is something that people were discussing. And, you know, again, I'm not here to give you conclusions, just simply to bring up this issue that potentially someone can say, listen, I paid for this seat, right? And you can argue, well, you paid for a ride from here to there. On the other hand, you know, we've had lawsuits recently with, and as you mentioned at the beginning of this year, very heavy people who took up more than one seat and who said, well, I'm one person. And the airline said, you're two seats.
Mm.
So there is something to be discussed from that point of view to say that it could be that this would be considered, you know, a rented area from a person who says, listen, you know, you can't be smelling bad and sitting near me, at least in terms of halacha. On the other hand, here we go. If you look at the next Gemara in Bava Basra, which is on the next page in source number 3, I'm not going to talk about the first case, which is, you know, in the Mishnah, you know, talks about having bakeries and this and that, and what can you have under them, above them, different cattle, barns. Let's just skip to the next Mishnah, which is Masnisin in the middle of the Hebrew, and in big letters Mishnah in the middle of the English. So we'll read it in the English here, you know, for the sake of clarity in the case. If a resident wants to open a store in his courtyard, his neighbor can protest to prevent him from doing so and say to him, I am unable to sleep due to the sound of people entering the store and the sound of people exiting. Okay? This Mishnah is talking about, really, what we know as Gezel Shena, which is also a very important halacha relating to airplanes and flights. I saw an article written that, you know, talked about the concerns and even mentioned this in regards to an airplane ride. You know, if someone's sleeping next to you, and, you know, you can avoid, you know, standing up and pushing them to the side and waking them up. That's probably a good thing to do. In fact, you even saw all sorts of different articles, you know. Best tips. How many times is it appropriate to wake up the person next to you on a long flight to go to the bathroom? You know, all sorts of interesting things. But this Mishnah is talking about Gezel Shena, really. Because He says, I can't fall asleep because people are making so much noise, okay? However, and therefore, if a person wants to open up some sort of large store in their house, and again, this is where we get back to zoning, what's a commercial area, what's a private, you know, what's a residential area, and things like that, and those have a lot of relevance, but potentially applicable to smell as well, right? You know, if someone says, I can't sleep because of the smell that's next to me, maybe you could make that same argument that it would apply. Now, here's the caveat. You can't open a store in your courtyard, but, says the Mishnah, one may fashion utensils in his house and go out and sell them in the market, despite the fact that he's not allowed to set up a store in the courtyard, and the neighbor cannot protest against him doing so and say to him, I'm unable to sleep due to the sound of the hammer you use to fashion utensils. Nor can he say, I cannot sleep due to the sound of the mill that you use to grind. Nor can he say, I cannot sleep due to the sound of the children. It's permitted for one to make reasonable use of his or her own home. So, that being said, looking back to our case, again, on the one hand, we're warned of, you know, invading other people's property with unnecessary noise, unnecessary odor. On the other hand, if you're in your house, people can't complain about what you do. And perhaps the argument could be made, again, I'm not saying this conclusively, perhaps the argument could be made here to say that if a person is in his seat, it's just, that's the way the houses are built on the airplane, that this house is right next to that house. And you know what? Maybe it sucks, but it could be, you could make an argument from here that if a person is just sitting in their seat, especially a family of three, if they have a seat, you know, a set of three rows or something, and they're even across the aisle from other people, you could make the argument, say, listen, they're there. I'm sorry it smells all the way from there to here, but they have the right to be there because that's their house. That being said, again, I'm not trying to make any judgments on this case at all. I don't know if they smelled or not. Again, the assumption that we should be believing is that they did not smell. Again, that's, I believe, you know, a halachic concern. I'm not saying that's a psak. But, you know, these are cases that you see applied to airplanes in terms of sleep and making noise around other people. I don't know why they might not apply equally to smell.
There's no barrier on an airplane, though.
That's correct, but the barrier is sort of being, you know, is not keeping the sound in this person's house, right? You know, and what would you say about people that are in the same house? You know, I'm a tenant in a basement. What if I decide to make a racket in my basement and the person upstairs says, hey, you're making so much noise. Do I get to say it's my house?
So I'm not sure if the same Mishnah would apply there, but for the same Gemara, but that might be different than two separate houses.
Okay, I mean, I could hear the argument. I could also hear the argument that on an airplane it would be analogous. I'll put it that way. I'm not trying to say this is conclusive. It certainly isn't. You're absolutely right. On the other hand, you know, there's something to be discussed, you know, in terms of something like this. I thought I saw a question somewhere else. Maybe not. Okay. Anyway, so this was, I thought, an interesting take on the story in terms of smells. These obviously were very relevant to halachos in terms of where people had to put their bathrooms in their backyards. You know, now they're less, you know, with modern plumbing, they are less relevant, the smell halachos, but, you know, still something to keep in mind. And in general, what comes out from this is sometimes we look at the small picture and we're looking at details, and the details of smells next to other people on an airplane. Looking at the bigger picture, the Torah always tries to have this be a haftal areach hakamocha type of concern. And that concern, in this case, applies both from someone who may potentially smell to the other people around them, but also to sort of treat people with respect a little bit. You know, as someone said, you're on a flight for a couple of hours, you know, how bad could the person smell already? People have been saying, you know, people have been commenting in all sorts of directions when I've discussed this with them. And, you know, it's hard to say what all of us would do in that circumstance, but, you know, you'd like to feel that what the Torah wants is for you to be as understanding as possible, whether you be the person who smells or whether you be the person who's smelling that person. And again, we don't know again what happened here, but certainly there's some lessons to take out in general. So I thought that was a cool first story for the day. The second one was maybe even cooler, though. This one made the news waves everywhere, and we're going to get out our multimedia presentation for this one again, as I, you know, like to do every once in a while. 911 dispatcher helps boy with his fractions homework. So here we go. Lafayette, Indiana. Police dispatchers are trained to deal with a number of situations, and a dispatcher in Indiana had to know her numbers when a boy called 911 seeking help with his homework. Lafayette.
Today was in the news.
Today? No, yesterday. Yesterday.
Oh. They should have started today.
Ah, okay. Well, I'll play the recording in a moment. But Lafayette's police dispatcher, Antonia Bundy, answered the call from the boy who said he had a bad day at school. It seemed the boy had tons of homework before the dispatcher narrowed down that he was having trouble with fractions. An audio recording of the call posted on Twitter shows how the dispatcher helped the child solve the equation 3/4 plus 1/4. She had him take out a piece of paper to figure out the answer. One. The boy thanked the dispatcher and apologized for calling 911. Police say they don't recommend calling 911 for homework help. I assume that is also a practical concern, not only because of the, you know, issues with the police department, but, you know, I was stuck on algebra. That's going to be my next place to call for ask for homework help. Okay, so here I'm going to get you the recording of the call. It may actually help you sort of get a feel for the circumstances and the situation. If I can get this to load, that is. Here we are. 1 second. And this is, yes, from the police department. It was posted online by the police department, okay? And here is the recording of the call.
Oh. Hi, can you hear me? Yes, I can hear you.
Here we are.
911. Hi, can you hear me? Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, you say what's your emergency?
I had a really bad day, and,
You had a bad day at school?
Yeah, I just came to tell you that.
Yeah, what happened at school that made you have a bad day?
I just had a tons of homework.
Oh, okay. What subject do you have homework in?
Math, and it's so hard.
Okay. So what are you learning in math? What's so difficult?
Fractions.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's
just so much better.
You're bad at fractions?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a problem you want me to help you with?
Yeah. What's 3/4 plus 1/4?
Okay. So
I saw it.
Do you have your paperwork in front of you, your homework?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you do 3/4, put that on your paper.
Okay.
And then do plus 1/4.
Okay.
Okay. So what's 3 + 1?
4.
Okay. And then what's... It would be over 4. So then 4/4... is what?
1?
Yeah, good job.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Was that your only problem?
Yeah.
Okay. So your homework is
done? Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry for calling you, but yep. I really need help.
You're fine. We're always here to help.
Okay. Thank you.
So there you have it. Please refrain from commenting on it now and here. Everybody's, you know, of course, entitled to their own opinion, but I don't want to get anything too objectionable on the recording.
The interview her also.
And you'll see all sorts of different, you know, people taking this in different ways. People saying this is terrible and horrible. People saying this is fantastic and great. And again, I'm not here to pass judgment on, just to talk about a couple of the halachic issues.
She has the same problem in grade 6. She has the same problem that there is the answer to.
Okay. Okay. The first question is one, let's assume she wasn't a police dispatcher for a moment. And that's obviously a big part, and we're going to talk about that next. But let's just say she was a regular employee working for a regular company. Let's say she was a telemarketer. Well, we're not talking about him wasting her time. We're talking about her wasting her time. And I don't necessarily think this is a waste. I mean, you know, we have to be very careful with what we say. But I thought I'd talk about a couple of stories which come up about taking time at work to talk to people. You know, which we may not think is so crazy. And if anybody wants to volunteer to read these stories, they're just stories. You can read the English. I'd love to have a, you know, break. I've been talking since an hour ago because I've had the... Dine and Learn before this, so if anybody wants to volunteer to read source number 4 in the English, I'd be very happy. Anyone?
Sure.
Go ahead, please. Thank you.
The Gemara relates another story, this time about Choni HaMagel's descendants, who are also renowned for their righteous deeds. Abba Chilkiah was the son of Choni HaMagel's son. And when the world was in need of rain, they would send sages to him, and he would pray for mercy, and rain would fall. Once the world was in need of rain, and the sages sent a pair of sages to him, so that he would pray for mercy, and rain would fall. They went to his house, but they did not find him there. They went to the field, and found him hoeing the ground. They greeted him, but he did not return their greeting. Abba Chilkiah said to his wife, I know that these sages have come due to the rain.
This was after the workday, by the way, that's why we have the ellipsis there.
I know that these sages have come due to the rain. Let us go up to the roof and pray for mercy. Perhaps the Holy One, blessed be He, will be appeased, and it will rain, and we will not receive credit ourselves for the rainfall. They went up to the roof. He stood in one corner, and she stood in the other corner. Clouds began to form on that side where his wife stood. When he descended, he said to the sages, Why have the sages come? They said to him, The other sages have sent us to the Master, so that you should pray for mercy for rain. He said to them, Blessed is God, who did not require you petition Abba Chilkiah, as the sky is filled with clouds, and rain is certainly on its way. They said to him, We know that the rain has come on the Master's account. However, let the Master please say and explain to us these aspects of your behavior that are puzzling to us. What is the reason that when we greeted the Master did not return our greeting? He said to them, I am a day laborer, hired for the day, and I said to myself that I may not delay my work to answer you.
So, he asks some more questions afterwards, and there's a whole response, but this is the main point we wanted to take out from this, which is, these people, first of all, I mean, you can imagine, these are pretty serious people that are coming to visit. It's very honorable people. It's two of the greatest rabbis of the time that are coming to visit Abba Chilkiah. Okay, he's working. He's doing whatever he says, you know, he's working the ground for someone else, and he's a worker. And he doesn't even answer them during his work, despite the fact that he knows they're coming to him for, you know, a very important need. These people aren't coming for no reason, potentially even one that's important for the world, right? You know, to have it rain. And he picks up on that later on when he talks to his wife about it. But we see someone so careful about every single second they you know, they're at work. He can continue working it while he's talking, right? We could say, ah, he's just talking to them at the same time. He's still doing his work, right? But you know what? He was so mocked, he says, no way. I said to myself, I may not delay my work to answer you. Just to say, hi, guys. I'll speak to you later. I'm working now. No. It reminds me, I was once at a minyan. And it was at Mariv after Shmon Esrei, and they were about to start Kaddish. And the person who was davening, the Shliach Tzibur, his phone went off. He picks it up. He says, sorry, I'm on the other line with God. I'll call you back in a bit. So, anyways, this is even better than that. He says, no, I'll call you back in a bit. He ignores the phone. Right? He says, I'm sorry. Right now I'm working for the person who I'm working for, and I have to do my work. I'm paid for being here today. So that's something, you know, a very important lesson to take from, and people would therefore question what she's doing, is saying, listen, she's not being, you know, paid to do homework with kids. This is not a homework club hotline. This is a hotline for people to call the police. Now, it could be argued that, listen, the job of the police dispatcher is to help the people out that call them, and it's not so far removed from her job, which is perhaps a fair argument to make, but let's look at something slightly different. If you look at another story in the Medrash Rabbah in Shemos, we have another volunteer to read. This one is much shorter, so less scary. Anyone? Please.
He was a gardener, asked our rabbis a blessed memory. He said to them, how was the earth first created? They told him, there's no man here who's an expert in these matters. Rather approach Abba Yosef the builder. He went and found him standing on a scaffold. Abnibo said, I have a question to ask you. Abba Yosef replied, I cannot descend because I'm a daytime laborer. Rather, ask what you want and I will answer you from up here.
So in this story, a slightly different story, where, again, you had someone very important coming to ask this Abba Yosef HaBanai, not Bob HaBanai, but Abba Yosef HaBanai, to ask him sort of this, you know, deep philosophical question. And you know what? He says, listen, I can't come down to talk to you, but you can shout up while I'm up there on the scaffold and I'll try to answer you. This is a bit more of a laxing, but again, we still see this consideration of saying, you know what? I can't do this. I'm at work now. And there's a lot more to be talking about for this. You know, we go a bit further. What are the halachos relating to davening at work? And it's very interesting. If you look at the Gemara here, and I'm sorry I didn't, you know, align the top line to the right all the way, stuck on the left, my apologies. With regard to laborers in source number 6, the sages taught in a Tosefta, laborers, while engaged in their labor, may recite Shema while standing atop the tree or atop the course of stones in a wall under construction. And they may pray atop the olive tree or the fig tree, as those trees have many branches close together, so one could stand on them and focus properly while praying. We're talking about Chazal saying, you don't even have to come down from your tree in order to daven. That's pretty big dispensation, because why? We see that people, you know, are expected to be doing their work. And how do we know that that's the case? In the case of all the rest of the trees, however, they must climb down and pray. However, the homeowner who is self-employed in all cases, regardless of the type of tree, must climb down as prey, as he will be unable to focus appropriately, since in contrast to the laborers, it is his prerogative to climb down and pray. The sages did not permit him to pray atop the tree. You see what the Gemara says? It says, why? Because Chazal saw that he doesn't have to stay up in the tree. He doesn't have to be there all day. He's self-employed. Only the worker has to be there up there. So the worker is allowed to daven up there. That's what the Chachamim said. But the person who owns the place himself, he can't do that. It's not a lechatchila, it's a bidyevid, because we see they have to be at work and they have to be working hard. Therefore, this is something they have to do. And, you know, it continues.
I guess it's, I was just thinking about, I guess, if they do daven in the tree, they're going to be losing time from their work. Anyways, I guess it's the time to ascend and descend.
Correct, that's what we're referring to. Yes, they are allowed to daven there. You know, obviously we're assuming that the person knows about it and they couldn't have done it else. You know, there's a lot of other factors to go into it. Yeah. But we do see there are some things that are allowed, but we try to minimize always the damage to the job.
Right.
Now, if you look in source number 7, it gets even better. Okay? What of using work time not for personal matters? And I quoted this from an article, but I could easily have quoted it from Israel. Yisharim the same, because that's all that it says. What of using work time not for personal matters, like Facebook, of course, but for genuine mitzvahs? For example, raising funds for tzedakah. The Ramchal writes in Mesilas Yesharim that a mitzvah like this is not a mitzvah at all, but theft, a sin especially despicable to God. He equates time stolen for a mitzvah with an object like an estrog or lulav stolen for a mitzvah. Rather than serving us as a heavenly advocate, it will take on the role of a prosecutor. Mesilas Yesharim, chapter 11. What we can see from all of these sources, and many, 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 many more, as well as the rest of that article, which was phenomenal, on workplace halacha, is that God doesn't think it's a great idea for you to be stealing from your employer, even if that means that you're doing something nice and something good. So someone to say, well, you know, God's going to be happy that I'm, you know, not working properly at work because I'm doing a mitzvah, or I'm helping someone with this. Too bad. God says, no, you got to do your work. If you're hired and you're being paid by the hour or by the day or whatever it is, you got to put in your full day's work. And if you don't do that, sorry, there's a problem. Now, can you stay afterwards? I mean, these all depend on the different scenarios at each workplace, and, you know, how lax they tend to be with that. Some places say, listen, you know, you got to get done your 8 hours if you want in the middle of the day to spend an hour on Facebook and stay late at night. Okay. Or some, you know, obviously there are some professions that are, you know, paid based on the actual products that they produce. You know, it reminds me of a famous sport, but I won't share it now. So that's something to think about, that, you know, if in this case we are to say this is not a proper use of this person's work time, then it could be argued that what she's doing is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Saying it's very nice that she's helping people, but it's not your job to help people when you're working for someone. And that could be an argument very strongly made. But Rabbi Torchiner, and I should thank him and Rabbi Abbey and, you know, the rest of the bunch. I discussed these cases with a lot of people, and, you know, many of the sources come from them. Many sources come from articles. Some of the sources I thought of myself. It's, you know, always a big mishmash. But, you know, the point is to have good research and come up with good sources. Rabbi Torchiner mentioned the following relevant, you know, sugya, which is, if unfortunately parents of young children both die and they are left orphans, often we will appoint an apotropos, who is basically someone to oversee the, you know, the property of the orphans. And the Gemara tells the following case. Now, normally, Shulchan Aruch paskins, and this is based on the Gemara, as we're going to see here, and elsewhere, that these people, these overseers, although they're allowed to make investments, and do whatever they feel is best and what the children would want done with their money, they're not allowed to give tzedakah. Okay, different reasons may be given. I mean, one of the most important reasons is that they're not chayiv in tzedakah, but there are other reasons given, as well as, says the Gemara here. That's what we're going to focus on.
Sorry, we're talking about the wards or the orphans are allowed. Who's not allowed to give tzedakah?
The person overseeing their money. The orphans are very, very young. The orphans are, you know, maybe 8 or 9 years older or younger. I mean, it really doesn't matter. As long as they're under bar mitzvah in this case. So says the Gemara. Let's actually, you can follow along in the English or in the Hebrew, but basically, Rabba Rama Tzedakah Ayasmi Divei Bar Merion. So Rava imposed a contribution to a certain charity on the orphans of the house of Bar Merion. And he basically took from their money and said, I'm giving this as tzedakah. Now, Amar Le Abaye, Abaye says, what are you doing? V'atani Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda Ein Poskin Tzedakah Al HaYasomen Afilu L'Pidyon Shvuyim. You can't even take tzedakah from orphans, even if it's for Pidyon Shvuyim. Okay, whatever the reason may be. Amar Le. So Abaye has a very strong question. Here and other places, and again, in the halachos of Apotropos and in Shulchan Aruch, we see this echoed as well, and I felt it only necessary to bring this Gemara to make the point across. Ask Abaye, what are you doing? How can you take their money for tzedakah? And says the Gemara, you can't even take their money for what? Even Pidyon Shvuyim, which is a huge mitzvah. You're redeeming someone from jail. They need the money. It doesn't matter. You're not allowed to take their money. Says Rabba back to Abaye, Amar Leh, Ana le'achshuvinhu ka'avidna. Charity has two parts to it, says Rabba. Charity can be given for a mitzvah, and along with that, you know what? You get a good name. You've become famous. People like you. Imagine, you know, if you have a big building built in your honor, it says the so-and-so, you know, school, the so-and-so yeshiva, the so-and-so shul. That's a big honor. Says Rava, this was not me giving tzedakah. This is me investing in them. So they should have a good name. Maybe now it'll benefit them in the future in some way, and that's why I did it. It wasn't because I'm taking tzedakah from them. It's because I'm doing something that will be beneficial. Good PR. Now, thinking back to this case, and that's not considered stealing, meaning normally we would say, you can't steal money from someone to take to tzedakah. But here we're saying, no, it's for PR. Because he's assigned, you know, this work, investing this money for PR purposes is okay. Now, if we look back at our case, what happened after this phone call was recorded? Let's think. Somehow, somewhere, the police, you know, hear about this, the other people. They post it online as a PR type of, you know, circumstance. So it could be argued, it could be, and again, this is definitely far from conclusive, but to say that doing something like this, which she knows will be beneficial in the long run to the company, is in fact doing her job, even if it's not technically part of the job description, even though it's technically not what she's supposed to be doing, she's causing a benefit to the police. Maybe people will know from now on that you're not supposed to call for your homework. I don't know what the purpose is. Maybe it's that more people will call 911 now. Again, I can't say for sure, but that's something to be considered, certainly, and to say that she did do something that, by and large, people looked upon very positively for the police department and for her. For her, it doesn't matter. We're caring about the police department here in terms of her work. Again, you could also argue that it's part of her work in terms of just helping people that call. People did note that there were other dispatchers that were there at the time, and they were still available the entire time to accept calls. That's something that's very important in terms of taking time. Probably not something that the employer minds about in a circumstance like this, but hard to say. Now, the reason why I played the recording was to talk about something else entirely. And, you know, maybe I should go back to the beginning of the recording just to illustrate what I mean here. So you'll give me a little bit of time. If you have any questions so far on what we've been discussing, I'm happy to take them now while I boot this back up.
Was she reprimanded at all by anybody?
It doesn't appear to be the case. It appears that she's lauded. But if we go back to the beginning, and here's the recording, okay? Listen up.
911. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, I had a really bad day, and, I don't know.
Okay, so stop. When you get there, what as a 911 operator might be going through your head?
Could there be somebody in trouble?
Right, this could be someone very in trouble. Mm-hmm. So, you could make a very strong argument, stronger than what we've been making until now, to say, this is her job. Mm-hmm. She's got to make sure this is not someone who's suicidal. She's got to make sure this is not someone who's going to hurt someone. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that can be happening. And
it's like a mental health.
Yeah. Correct. And I think that from that perspective, and especially when you just listen to the beginning, like, we're laughing at it, like, oh, what can I help you with next? But this can really make a difference for some people, and it's very likely that this is a circumstance where, you know, either, at this point, the fact that she doesn't hang up is very obvious. She's got to make sure what's going on. To continue the call for an extra 30 seconds, you know, is to make sure that everything's really okay. She's almost triaging, you know, and to some extent for a lot of the phone call to see, you know, what's really going on with this kid? Is he okay? You know, is this something that's going to happen? Is a parent mad at the kid and going to harm the kid? You don't know. I mean, there was a story someone told me about a couple of years back where a 911 call received, hi, I'd like to order a pizza. And the operator says, rather than slamming the phone, says, okay, where would you like to order the pizza to? And says an address. And sure enough, it was a person who was in a circumstance where they couldn't talk. So they feigned calling a pizza for a delivery, and this dispatcher had enough brains, I guess, to figure out the circumstance and was able to send the cops there. And this was something that happened a few years back, but it was a very relevant case at the time. You know, it's hard to know, and these people are trained to sort of pick up on these things and to realize when it is their job to really look into this further and help out to the extent that they can. And I don't think that's something, you know, certainly here that is unreasonable to assume. And once that's the case, we look to, you know, the second question of the bunch, which I didn't go into in detail at all, but as we turn to sources number 9 and number 10, which is the other question that people ask. They say, and we already dismissed this by saying there were other dispatchers available, but you're supposed to be saving lives. What are you doing on the phone with this kid? And I think on the phone with this kid, and I would have wanted to go more into this, but between the space and the time and the third article that someone please asked me to read this week, so I didn't want to get into it further, but the question is, if you're on such a call, and you're saying there's, let's say, a 5% chance that someone's in trouble, do you have the right to hang up that call according to Jewish ethics and pick up a call which you have no idea what could be going on? It could be a prank call for all you know. It could be someone who's getting shot, right? So those questions relating to the ethical perspective and the lo sam or al dam reyacha is, you know, the Gemara talks about who says his blood is any redder than yours when it comes to two people having a chance to live. And frankly, perhaps you could apply the same ideas, and I didn't want to get into detail on this, although there's a lot to talk about. The case that is most analogous is regular triage at a hospital. Whom do you treat first? If two people come in, you know, at similar times, or one person comes in after another, but, you know, you're more likely to be able to save them. These are really serious questions that have to be tackled by ethicists and also halachic authorities, and, you know, are in fact tackled by them. I didn't, again, want to go into so much detail at this point, but certainly to realize that while we may look at it first and say, what's she doing this during her job, and how dare she, other people could be dying because she's sitting on the phone with the kid, we're not taking into consideration the other side of things from both halacha, in saying that, you know what, there are certain allowances which you can do with your employer's time, specifically if it's to benefit them. But number two, in terms of this ethical side of things, of saying, it's not necessarily clear that there's no risk here and there is a risk in the other case. And even if there would be, you know, what would be the ramification, or I should say, if there's a small risk in this case and a larger risk in, you know, answering the phone, it's not clear that that would even be the right thing to do. So that's something that I thought was, you know, important to bring to the fore in this case and discuss a little bit. You know, and I think we'll leave this here.
Could I ask a quick question?
Sure.
On source number 8,
mm-hmm.
It says he replied, Ana la'akshvaninu kavidna.
Mm-hmm.
So you translated it as he wanted to make them look choshuv, like to give them a good name.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you give me $100. I'm a shomer or shomer chinam. Let's say you give me $100 to mm-hmm. watch over. And then I see a marvelous, a wonderful tzedakah opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not allowed. Would I be allowed to, let's say, give them $10 of the money you told me to look over in order to be mezakeh you to a mitzvah?
No.
That's what I mean.
No.
No.
No. Not even close. It's just stealing.
Oh.
Yeah. You know. I mean, otherwise, people. I had this story once. And this is a very sad story.
Yeah.
But I was once at someone else's house, and I was watching the house for them. It was a relative's house, and they left, you know, a stack of these Zichron Binyamin vouchers at the door, And they told me, anytime someone comes to ask for money, you can give them this and this amount. And they told me, you know, one of these vouchers or two of these vouchers, whatever it was, and, you know, I'm not going through the details of the amounts. It was a significant amount, though. This was, you know, someone who's fairly generous. And, you know, I get to the door, and the person says, hi, you know, I have this issue, and I'm ill, and I'm getting married, and this, and you'll never know what I'm going through. And I said, I'm really sorry to hear that. And I took off, you know, this amount this person would give, and give it to this person. A significant amount of money. It wasn't, you know, 50 cents. It wasn't a dollar. It was, you know, a little bit more. You know, a bit more. And the person tells me, how dare you? You don't know what it's like to be in my circumstance. You should give me triple that. And I told him, I said, listen, I feel terrible for you, but this is not my money. I had given him, I think, a contribution for myself as well, actually, in this case. If not, then I didn't have any money, but I remember, like, and he told me, I said, listen, the person whose money this is told me I can only give out this certain amount. He says, well, he doesn't know either. You should give me more. So I said, listen, you know, I'm sorry. I can't steal from him. Listen, the voucher is here. If you want to take it and run with it, take it and run with it. But I can't give it to you. I said, if you feel comfortable saying that the person, you know, doesn't know what circumstance you're in, and despite the fact that he said, give a maximum of this, you're just going to take more and steal it? Okay. And again, there were different words that I tried to do it in obviously the most compassionate way that I could. And I felt terrible. I genuinely felt bad for this person. I'd really given him what I had and what I was allowed to be given from this other person. And it's tough because there's a whole bunch of money there in front of you. But you can't do that. You can't take other people's money and say, you know, oh, I'm giving you a mitzvah. No, what you're doing is taking their money and stealing it. Yeah, I mean, that's the case really of Abba Trump, is there are other reasons why you can't force people to give tzedakah and, you know, all sorts of other details. But, you know, an excellent question for sure and should be looked into with more sources, but I do believe that it's not allowed to take someone else's money and give it away. Yes. Okay, I mean, unless you know that maybe they would allow you, then there's what you want to talk about, or they told you to do that, but, yeah. There's a very nice article here that someone sent in. It really has nothing to do, well, nothing directly to do, per se, with what accompanies it, but they sent me both this article and the Dvar Torah that follows from Rabbi Jacobson. I'm not sure we actually truthfully need to do this during this year now. The article is fascinating, about a rare book about, you know, listings, the statistics of Jews in the United States and Canada who did work for Hitler and gave this to Hitler, you know, in sort of the next step in bringing the final solution to North America. Quite frightening to think about. But anyways, a very interesting article. They forwarded me on also this nice article from Rabbi Jacobson, which I copied out here. Nazism versus Islamic fundamentalism, talking about reading the Ten Commandments from both top to bottom, as well as side to side. Because we have two luchos, five number one, right, you know, the five first commandments, and the second group of five commandments, and talking about how they must be interlinked. Essentially, if you go down, let's take a look. And I see I forgot to erase footnote number three, but all the rest of the footnotes are erased. If you skip to the next page. Man could and ought to replace God. It's about five lines down. Left to his own devices, the thinking went, the human being will reach greatness. This truth, however, was reduced to ashes in the gas chambers of Auschwitz together with the 1.25 million people who were exterminated there. For it was precisely the nation that had excelled in science, music, literature, culture, philosophy, and ethics that turned out to be the most depraved nation of the world, sending 1.5 million children to their deaths during World War II solely because they had Jewish blood flowing in their veins. In Schindler's List, there is a scene during the liquidation of the Krakow ghetto where a little girl hiding in a piano is shot dead by an SS guard. As her little angelic body is covered in a river of blood, another guard sits down to play the piano. First SS guard, was ist das? Ist das Bach? Second SS guard, nein, Mozart. First SS guard, Mozart? Second SS guard, ja. And they both marvel at the exquisite music. This was Nazi Germany at its best, not a nation of illiterate peasants falling prey to barbaric instinct. No, this was a nation professing great intellect and culture and a sensitivity to aesthetics. Their genocide of a nation in the most systematic and organized fashion was done in the name of ethics and morality. The world needed to be cleansed from the vermin of the Jew. Many SS guards would spend a day in Auschwitz gassing 12,000 Jews and then return home in the evening to pet their dogs and laugh with their wives. As the smoke of Jewish children ascended from the crematoriums, these charming romantics would enjoy the taste of good wine, women, and music. The super race murdered millions of innocents all in the name of a developed ethic. Elie Wiesel, who gripped the world's imagination with his book Night, A Personal Testimony of Life and Death in Auschwitz, once asked Lubavitcher Rebbe, who himself lost many members of his family in the Holocaust, how he could believe in God after Auschwitz. If God existed, Wiesel asked, posing the great single greatest challenge to faith, how could he ignore 6 million of his children, dehumanized and murdered in the cruelest of fashions? The Rebbe shed a tear and then replied, in whom do you expect me to believe after Auschwitz? In man? This must remain one of the lasting legacies of Auschwitz. If there is any faith at all left after the extermination of 6 million people, it must glean its vitality from something transcending the human rationale and its properties. If morality is left to be determined exclusively by the human mind, it can become a morality that justifies genocide. In Auschwitz, the empathy that we once believed modern man felt for others was ruined forever. Nazi Germany demonstrated that for all time, that if I am the Lord your God is deleted from the equation of life, you shall not murder will soon be erased as well. As Dostoevsky famously put it in The Brothers Karamazov, I don't know how to read that, sorry, where there is no God, all is permitted. Without God, the path is paved to the creation of a hell on earth by way of the guillotine, the gulag, and the gas chamber. The atheist philosopher Bertrand Russell wrote, I cannot see how to refute the arguments for the subjectivity of ethical values, but I find myself incapable of believing that all that is wrong with wanton cruelty is that I don't like it. Russell's point is critical. Without God, we cannot objectively define any behavior as good or evil. As difficult as it is to entertain, no one can objectively claim that gassing a mother and her children is any more evil than eating cheesecake. It is all a matter of taste and opinion. The validity and effectiveness of You Shall Not Murder can be sustained only if it is preceded by the foundation of faith in a universal moral creator who gave humanity an absolute and unwavering definition of what constitutes good versus evil. Professor Abraham Joshua Heschel, who escaped Warsaw a few weeks before it was invaded and who lost most of his family in the Nazi Holocaust, captured the sentiment succinctly. If man is not more than human, then he is less than human. Either we climb to a place beyond ourselves, or we are likely to fall to a place below ourselves. When the vision of the sacred dies in the soul of a person, he or she is capable of becoming a servant of the devil. And basically to say that, as we had in the Aseret HaDibros in the last week's Parsha, you cannot divorce the first panel from the second panel. Saying, you know, listen, all these ethics that are Lotirtzach, Lotinaf, Lotignov, those are enough to steer me in the right direction is wrong. On the other hand, as he argues in his next part, which we didn't bring on this list, is that you can sometimes have only God driven morals without the sort of, you know, human and moral side. I shouldn't say God-driven morals. You can only have, you know, acting in the name of God that's not done morally, which is also wrong and is what leads to, as he calls it, Islamic fundamentalism, which, as we know, is not that great. Despite it being in the name of religion, it is not correct. So anyways, I thought that was a beautiful thought on the Aseret HaDibros and connected to this fascinating article about this newly found and newly bought book. Overall, I thought it was, a few interesting takes on articles where originally our first look at them is to say there's something wrong with that. And then once we reconsider it, say, you know what, maybe there may be room within halacha and the Torah to justify such behaviors, not in the case, chalila v'chas, you know, of the third story that we discussed, but in the first two cases, to look at something and say, that may not be as bad as we think, and to take that message out of it towards life and say, hey, you know, let's not be so quick to judge others. Thank you. Thank you.